From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, President Joe Biden is in Michigan visiting the Ford plant set to produce the automaker's all-new electric F-150.
There is no electric vehicle pickup truck market yet, so we don't know how much demand there is for it.
And waiting for the president in Dearborn is a large crowd of protesters upset at Biden's handling of the violence in Gaza.
And so people of this community has kind of really come together really quickly to sort of respond to the concerns of the community and the pain that I think a lot of them are feeling.
Also today, the conservation success story of the trumpeter swan in Michigan.
By 1959, actually, there were only 69 trumpeter swans in the United States that were known in the United States.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, President Joe Biden pays a visit to Dearborn, and as he does, large crowds of protesters have gathered in response to the battle raging in Gaza.
You got people wearing their keffiyeh scarves. You've got a ton of Palestinian flags, people carrying signs. There's a lot of people. They've showed up and they've shown out today.
We're going to speak today with a reporter on the scene. That's coming up later in the hour. But first, while the Middle East is dominating much of the headline space this week, the president's visit to Dearborn is actually focused on other priorities. He's here to get a preview of the new Ford Lightning, an F-150 the company hopes will be a game changer. This electrified version of a Ford classic is the subject of much curiosity, both for F-150 fans and the wider industry. Joining us today are Mike Martinez. He covers Ford and other beats for Automotive News. Hi, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
And Michelle Krebs is with us, too. She's Senior Director of Automotive Relations for Cox Automotive and an Executive Analyst for Auto Trader. Michelle, nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
Mike, I know you're coming to us from Dearborn today. Do you want to explain where you are?
I am, sure. I am at the new Ford Rouge Electric Vehicle Center. It's still partly under construction. It's all enclosed, though. This is where they will build the new F-150 Lightning starting next spring. It's still on the site adjacent to the Dearborn truck plant on the little compound of the Rouge vehicle complex.
Can you give us a sense of the scale and how it compares to other Ford operations in Dearborn?
Well, I don't have the square footage or anything off the top of my head, but I can tell you that standing here inside of it, it's about what you would think an automotive manufacturing plant would look like. It's massive. Ford won't get into any volume targets for the F-150 Lightning, but you can imagine that there'll be plenty of machinery in here, plenty of opportunity to have, you know, just like normal production lines for a gas-powered truck.
Right. Michelle, there'll be folks listening right now who are less up to speed on what Dearborn has meant to Ford's operations in the past. Can you fill us in on the history?
Well, going way back, the Rouge plant used to make, that was in the Henry Ford, the first days, with the idea of making everything. They made the glass, they made the steel, they made the vehicles, and then it was transformed into the truck plant some time ago. It's a critical element to Ford's manufacturing operations.
Mike, it feels like the company's plan for the Rouge Electric Vehicle Center is sort of its flag in the sand of where things are headed going forward. Is that how you've heard executives talk about it?
Exactly. And this product is really at the centerpiece of their ambitions. Ford said for a long time now it wants to electrify its icons. And you saw that with the Mustang Mach-E, but it really doesn't get more iconic than the F-150, right? It's been the best-selling vehicle in the nation for decades, the past 44 years, I believe. So they're taking their most important product and making it an EV.
I feel like some of the major automakers have so very clearly stated where their intentions lie in terms of electrification. And I guess the most obvious example would be General Motors, which has committed to an all-electric future. And Ford is just so well known, like you say, Mike, as a maker of trucks, a maker of SUVs. Michelle, could you talk about where the rollout that's happening this week, where that positions Ford with respect to the rest of the industry going forward?
Well, I think it's going to be really interesting because Ford isn't the only one that's rolling out an electric pickup truck. General Motors will be this fall with a GMC Hummer. And then we've got upstarts like Tesla and Rivian, which is also in Michigan. So, and what's interesting is there is no electric vehicle pickup truck market yet. So we don't know how much demand there is for it. Will people who want to buy a pickup truck go for an electric truck from Ford or GM, or will they want to go with the upstarts? I'm fascinated to see how this is all going to occur. And I think the other question is there enough for everybody? Are there enough electric pickup truck shoppers to go around for all of the players that are in the game? It'll be interesting to watch.
It feels like we're about to find out. Mike, tell us a little bit about who's on site today for the president's visit.
Well, we have a whole slew of delegates, congressional delegates from Michigan. They're on hand. So is Rory Gamble. He's the president of the UAW, the first African-American president of the UAW, took over about a year and a half ago. Obviously, the union is closely aligned with President Biden and his administration's ambitions. Although when Biden has visited in the past, both as president and on the campaign trail, Rory hasn't been able to meet him. And I know that's been something that's been on his agenda. So it'll be a chance for them to connect. Then, of course, you have all the top executives here from Ford, including CEO Jim Farley and Bill Ford, the executive chairman.
What has the union had to say about the new electric production at Rouge?
Well, that's going to be really interesting because, as I said, the UAW has typically backed the Biden administration and its agenda. They're a little nervous about this whole oncoming wave of electric vehicles. They want to make sure these vehicles, first of all, are built in the U.S. by union workers. And there's some concern that with these EVs, there could be fewer parts needed to assemble them, which means fewer workers. They're also trying to influence the Biden administration as it comes out with this infrastructure and jobs plan that will likely include an expansion of EV tax credits. They're hoping the administration makes those credits conditional on whether or not a vehicle will be built in the U.S.
Mike, I saw some photos that you tweeted out from the scene. There were Ford F-150s on one side of the room and Broncos and Mustangs on the other. In case anybody didn't get the message, iconic vehicles, and more iconic vehicles on the eve of this lightning rollout. It feels like they're trying to tell people to expect more of the same, right?
Exactly. Iconic vehicles, but most importantly, built in America, iconic vehicles. Ford really prides itself and will tell anybody who will listen that it makes more vehicles in the U.S. than any other automaker. And that's certainly a message it's trying to get across as the president visits. One notable exception to all these vehicles laid out is the Mustang Mach-E, which they currently build in Mexico.
Ah, right. This is a delicate thing that we're talking about here with the politics of the situation. Auto workers have been such a coveted portion within Michigan's electorate. You know, a lot of auto workers were among the Reagan Democrats back in the 80s, and they've been a crucial piece of the swing vote in decades since then. Mike, I know what you're saying about how the union's leadership has been aligned with the Biden administration. Do you get much of a sense that rank and file auto workers are friendly toward Joe Biden or have been in 2020, most notably?
Well, there was a sort of infamous dust up when then candidate Biden came to visit a Ford facility during the campaign and he got into it with a contract worker. There was some shouting back and forth. I wouldn't say that there's a collective thought for or against. Rank and file members are very opinionated. They often do not align with the UAW leadership on a lot of views. They often don't align typically with a Democrat or Republican. They have, you know, they had plenty of gripes with President Trump and now with President Biden as well. I will say, though, that I think there is just, again, a general sense of concern or worry when we talk about EVs and the future for these workers who have known a certain way of building cars for a century now. And there's some concern whether or not their jobs will be found if all these automakers start to invest heavily in changing the form of propulsion.
We'd be remiss if we didn't note the stakes here. Next year is going to be pretty important to Joe Biden's agenda, meaning to say the administration is probably hoping to turn out enough sympathetic voters to hold on to congressional majorities or else face a potentially frustrating second half of a term. Michelle, let's talk a little bit more about that future and why there's a bit of nervousness within manufacturing about it. As we mentioned earlier, electrified vehicles are very different beasts. Can you talk a bit about what electrified trucks might mean and what electric vehicles overall are meaning in terms of domestic manufacturing?
Well, and to build on what Mike said, yes, there aren't as many parts with electric vehicles. I visited the Audi plant in Belgium that makes their e-tron, which is their EV. And it was one of the quietest plants with the fewest people I've seen. And that is a huge concern with the UAW, with unions in Europe, about the number of employees who will be needed. And think beyond the assembly plant. Think about, we won't need engine and transmission plants per se, which are now UAW represented by the Detroit 3. There's a big fight about to begin with General Motors and the union over who will make the batteries. Will it be unionized workers? Because those are joint venture plants with LG Chem, their battery partner, and they have to establish new unions. And that's going to be an interesting battle.
I want to ask both of you what you'll be watching for, both with Biden's visit and the formal Ford Lightning rollout on Wednesday night. Mike, do you want to start? And then maybe Michelle, you can finish this up.
Sure. Well, with the president's visit, I am curious how much he'll talk to battery production. To piggyback off what Michelle said, Ford so far has not really been in the battery production game, but it's dropped very strong hints that it will be soon. It's an area of vertical integration they are starting to think will benefit them and help them drive down costs. So I'm curious to see if the president will call on automakers like Ford to invest and build battery plants here in the U.S., and we'll see if Ford has a response at this point. Just in terms of the F-150 Lightning reveal tomorrow night, I'm curious to see if Ford can do what it wants to do in terms of offering customers a compelling reason to buy an EV. You know, there's been some shyness on the part of consumers. EVs still represent about 2% of the market, but Ford thinks it has an answer by offering them more capability and essentially more power, more stuff in the vehicle than they could offer in a gas-powered truck. So once they come out with all these details, once we see the product, I'm curious what customer reaction will be.
Michelle, how about you?
The same, because we know from our surveys, the three obstacles to EV adoption are price, range, and the EV charging infrastructure. So I will be interested in seeing how Ford addresses all that. And on the administration side, same question. I think we can view this visit by Biden as he's on the campaign trail for the infrastructure package, which has a lot of things that will push EVs along. Got to bring the consumer along, though.
Michelle Krebs is Senior Director of Automotive Relations for Cox Automotive and Executive Analyst for Auto Trader. We've also been talking with Mike Martinez from Automotive News. Mike, Michelle, it's a real pleasure. Thanks for taking time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, hate crimes against Asian Americans have been on the rise over the past year. We're going to speak to a researcher who's digging into the data about what's going on. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Fear has been a big part of pandemic life. But some of us are experiencing fear in a very specific way. Racist attacks on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have increased over the past year. New research from the University of Michigan offers some insights into the location, the nature, and the perpetrators of anti-Asian hate incidents that have happened in the U.S. during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Virulent Hate Project reviewed 4,337 news articles dating back to 2020 that addressed coronavirus-related anti-Asian racism in the U.S. From those articles, researchers identified 1,023 unique incidents of anti-Asian racism. Melissa May Borja is a lead researcher on the project. She's also an assistant professor in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan. I spoke with Melissa about the rise in hate crime earlier this year. You've been active with a group that originally started out of California called Stop AAPI Hate, AAPI being Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. And this group started up as a sort of reporting center on March 19th, 2020. What can you tell us about the type of incidents that you and other folks in the group were hearing about and what you wanted to keep tabs on?
Right. So there has been a very alarming rise in acts of hate against Asian American and Pacific Islander people in the United States associated with the pandemic. And these acts of hate were reported in the news as early as January and February. Some were acts of verbal harassment, and some were horrific acts of violence. So Stop AAPI Hate began as a collaboration of academics and activists associated with community organizations to understand these trends, both to inform public policy and also guide the activism of community organizations. And we found that the pandemic really did see a rise in attacks against Asian Americans. I think one thing that's very challenging about doing any sort of work about Asian Americans is spread out across the country, Asian Americans aren't necessarily a very large population. They live often in states like California or New York, but if you live in a place like Indiana or Michigan, Asian American issues are often overlooked because compared to the rest of the population, it's a pretty small community. But what Stop AAPI Hate really usefully did is collect all of the information happening all across the country in order to say this is a problem that is not just a one-off event. It's widespread, it's common, it's happening a lot. Asian Americans are fearful and political leaders need to be held accountable.
Right. You've written about the partisan rhetoric that blames Asian people and Asian American people for the pandemic. This specifically tracked, this was a specific tracking of social media posts, among other things. This is a relevant issue for Michiganders because there have been some elected officials in Michigan who've used phrases like the Wuhan virus or the China virus. Can you make the link for us between a tweet like that or something that, you know, that blames wet markets for the pandemic and the personal safety and mental health of folks in the community?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people who aren't aware of this problem, it seems harmless to use a term like Wuhan coronavirus, but it actually really matters. Well before the COVID-19 pandemic began, major health organizations like the WHO had guidelines to recommend people naming diseases in a way that doesn't stigmatize a group of people or a place, that doesn't associate a disease with a particular community. What we saw in March, though, was politicians using terms like China virus and Chinese virus with increased frequency. And it's hard to draw a causal relationship, but it certainly does coincide. When politicians use language like Wuhan flu or Kung flu, it coincided with a rise in anti-Asian hostility, anti-Asian discrimination, anti-Asian violence. It got to the point where even the FBI was warning of increased hate crimes against Asian Americans because of the association with association between Asian Americans and the coronavirus. I think one of the most striking incidents that took place in March, which was the month when many politicians, the most prominent of which was Donald Trump, used terms explicitly like China virus, despite the fact that people were asking him not to do so. We saw during that month a really horrific incident in Texas where a Burmese family was shopping on a Saturday, two young children under the age of 6, the father and the 2 sons were stabbed in the face. And what's notable about that incident is it precipitated the FBI to release a statement warning of rising violence against Asian Americans. But that incident also involved the person who stabbed the family explicitly blaming them for the coronavirus. So I did that study with my team really to see the partisan patterns and other patterns of who is using those terms. And we were pretty surprised to see both how insistent some politicians were in using those terms, how casual they were in using those terms. And we continue to emphasize that it's dangerous to do any of those things. You could call the coronavirus the coronavirus. You could use a term like COVID-19. You don't need to use a term like Wuhan flu. That was hurtful to my community.
We live in a culture that poses a lot of different kinds of direct threats to many different people of color. There are a lot of Americans who spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff because of Black Lives Matter. And I feel like We're in this place where some people might think about police violence against Black Americans and Latino Americans and start to see things in terms of a hierarchy of threats. If a person is Asian American, they might think, well, you know, I see what's happening in the streets of this country every day. Maybe what's happening to me is not really, it's not really worth talking about. This idea of a hierarchy of harm that happens because of racism, do you see that affecting our response to what AAPI folks are experiencing right now?
This is a complicated question, and I think Asian Americans have always found themselves in a complex racial position in the United States, where historically the conversation about race has been very much along a Black-white binary. The question of where Asian Americans fit into that is challenging and complicated. I think it's pretty clear if you look at U.S. history, Asian Americans have very frequently been subjected to violence. And I think this is a key point that's often overlooked, that the anti-Asian racism and violence that we are seeing in the current moment is not new, that there are many instances of racism and violence against Asian American that go back to the 19th century. I think one aspect of this conversation about a hierarchy of harm is that it reflects that we don't actually know a lot about Asian Americans and their place in American history. And I think that if we thought about contemporary violence and racism against Asian Americans in light of histories of exclusion, in light of histories of incarceration of Japanese Americans, of the colonization and the war against Filipinos, I think we might have a different view of where Asian Americans fit into the conversation about racism in the U.S. I would also say one thing that has been notable about responses to violence in the past month, it has been the very explicit call for solidarity among Black and Asian American activists. So in the wake of the killing the Thai American man last month, we saw last week Black and Asian Americans in the Bay Area hold a march of solidarity together. And I think that that is really where we're going to see things go moving forward.
Yeah. Some of the high-profile events that Stop AAPI Hate has been tracking happened in Texas, like you say, or the Bay Area or California. But you've also documented instances of harassment in Michigan. What can you tell us?
Yeah, I think this is a really important point because we often tend to think that issues facing Asian Americans are California issues or New York issues, which is to say that these incidents don't happen here in Michigan or in the Midwest, where people are friendly and where there aren't that many Asian American people to begin with. But what I think is a really important point is that this is a national problem. So I'll just give a few examples. In March in Detroit, March 2020 in Detroit, a man was working at a Polish meat market and a customer told him that he didn't want Chinese hands on his meat. He was yelled to go back to China and take the virus with him. We saw in the same month a virtual meeting of the Board of Trustees where people interrupted the meeting and made racially and sexually charged comments against Chinese people and Asian people. We saw in Shelby Township in April a trail sign in a park that had graffiti on it that blamed Asian people for COVID. So these are common, surprisingly common events. Stop AAPI Hate has been tracking these incidents through two means. My team looks at hate incidents that are reported in news media, and another team looks at hate incidents that are self-reported from Asian Americans themselves. And they're coming from all across the country in various forms. And I should emphasize, it's striking that these events are occurring even as we have largely been staying at home during the pandemic. So I do wonder if things would have been worse if we were out and about more often. But we are staying home and they're still happening. People are still having these hate incidents happen when they're just going about their daily business. And that's alarming.
Melissa, do you think that Asian American Pacific Islander folks who are in this community, do you think they tend to self-edit when they're talking about these incidents, whereas maybe they don't even see them or talk about them as something deserving of some larger attention?
I think that there is a lot of self-editing. I don't know if this is unique to Asian Americans, to be honest. I think that a lot of people who experience harmful and hurtful incidents don't report them, sort of as a general rule. But I do think that there are some cultural barriers that exist. So there is some evidence that suggests that Asian Americans who are from another country and are immigrants to the United States might not necessarily realize that a hate crime or a hate incident is a thing, that they could seek help from a community organization or law enforcement about. A student of mine recently did an informal survey of Asian American business owners in Sterling Heights and found that a surprisingly large percentage of them didn't really have a plan for what they would do if their businesses were involved in some sort of bias incident. And so I think a lot of the underreporting has to do with the lack of awareness that this is something that they could report and they should report, and a lack of awareness about how to handle them if they do experience something like it. I also do have to acknowledge, I think, something that is related to what you brought up, which is about this idea of self-editing. I think it's a real thing that Asian American people might not be familiar with talking about racism or as comfortable talking about racism. You know, I was born and raised in Michigan. My parents lived in Michigan in the early 1980s, and I recently asked them what it was like living during the time of the killing of Vincent Chin. And they said it was safer, in their view, at that time, just to keep quiet. And I don't think that's an uncommon view among a lot of Asian Americans who are relatively new to the United States, that it might be safer just to keep quiet. So I think there is a lot of education that's necessary to do.
This feels like kind of a strange question, but why is it important for us to talk in an unvarnished way about the fear that people feel or the anger they feel when they hear about this stuff happening?
By the unvarnished fear that Asian Americans feel? Yeah. Is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it feels truthful. I think it's important for us to be honest and truthful about how people are afraid. I can't tell you how many times over the past year I have heard friends and neighbors speak about their fear of just going to the grocery store. And I will speak honestly here when I say that I did not go to the grocery store myself until June. I sent someone else to get groceries for me, not simply because I was afraid of getting the coronavirus, but because I had known so many people who are spit on, targeted in verbal attacks just for doing daily activities. And to not talk about that, to not talk about that contemporary racism and harm, and to not talk about the history that informs that racism and harm, feels untruthful and dishonest. And, you know, I'm not always quite sure what to make of people saying, well, that they didn't know about anti-Asian racism until this moment. Part of me wonders, well, did you learn about Japanese incarceration in school? Did you learn about the killing of Vincent Chin in school? It indicates to me, if this is a new topic, then we really need to rethink how we are educating our American public.
I was thinking about what you said about having conversations with, you know, mothers and fathers and grandfathers who've maybe been in this country for a long time, maybe were born here and have been dealing with it their whole lives, and how, you know, they can sometimes, you know, feel like it's better not to say anything. I think that really says something about how long this has been going on in this country and how deeply it's felt.
I think that's right. I think also that the research indicates that the longer people are in the United States, and by people I'm here speaking about Asian immigrants and Asian Americans, the longer that Asian Americans are in the United States, the more likely they are to support policies like affirmative action and progressive policies regarding race. I think that it is kind of a daunting thing to step into if you're relatively new in the United States, but the longer you are here in the United States, I think a lot of Asian Americans realize, oh, racism is a real problem and it affects me. You know, I think for a lot of Asian Americans, it might feel comforting to, to buy into the fiction that racism doesn't affect them. But I think it becomes clear to people pretty quickly that racism is a real problem and that it does affect Asian Americans, and that it does nobody any good to stay quiet about it, that it really is in service to oneself and one's children and one's next generation to be honest and truthful and courageous about speaking out about it.
Melissa May Borja is an assistant professor in the Department of American Culture at the University of Michigan. Melissa, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
In just a moment, a wildlife comeback story. How trumpeter swans returned to Michigan, and how to spot them this spring. That's after the break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you take notice of the birds in your neighborhood, or maybe you go out and do some bird watching on the weekends, you know that birds in Michigan are nesting right now and hatching a lot of new babies. There are birds of abundance, such as robins, that a lot of us have nesting on or near our homes. And then there are more rare birds that feel special to see, especially with their babies. Such is the case of the trumpeter swan.
They're just so graceful.
That's Lori Newland. She lives near a wetland in southeast Michigan where a pair of trumpeter swans just nurtured and hatched 8 fluffy gray baby cygnets.
Like, look at that little one. Sometimes I even come down and just check on them on the weekends if I'm not going, just because they make me feel good, you know? So.
The trumpeter swan is a native species that once numbered in the tens of thousands in the Great Lakes region. It was wiped out in Michigan more than 100 years ago, thanks to a decades-long intensive effort by the W.K. Kellogg Bird Sanctuary at Michigan State University. The trumpeter swan is gaining ground in Michigan. Here to tell us more is Sarah DePue-Bobby. She's an avian caretaker at the Kellogg Bird Sanctuary. Sarah, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having us. We're super excited to be a part of the program.
So I think when a lot of people think swan, they think of the all-white bird with black face markings, but the trumpeter swan looks a little different than that archetype, which is what we think of as another variety called the mute swan. What are the distinguishing features of a trumpeter so that we know them when we see them?
Well, the trumpeter swan is North America's heaviest flying bird, so they're a very large white bird. And you can distinguish them between the invasive mute swan because trumpeters have an all-black bill, and the mute swans have an orange bill with a black, we call it a knob, right at the base of their bill where the bill meets their head. So the mute swans have an orange bill, trumpeter swans have a black bill.
So the mute swan is an invasive species then?
It is. Mute swans were brought over with some of the first colonists in the 1800s, and they are actually more populous in a lot of states, including Michigan, than our native trumpeter swan.
Interesting. I know that trumpeters at certain times of year have orange or rust-colored markings on their heads and necks. Can you tell us when we could expect to see that?
Yeah, so the orange or rust coloring on their feathers, it actually comes from where they are feeding. So if there's a lot of iron in the water, it will color their feathers. Just like if you have really hard water at your house and maybe you get laundry stains on your clothes. And when they molt their feathers in the summer, then they will grow in white feathers again and then kind of start the process all over.
What are their dispositions like? I know mute swans can frankly be a little crabby sometimes. Are trumpeter swans very aggressive?
They can be, especially during nesting season. Most of the time, I wouldn't say that they're pretty docile, but they tend to be a little more peaceful than mute swans, perhaps. But definitely during nesting season, they're a really big bird, and they can be aggressive because they're protecting their babies. So if you think of a Canada goose, but multiply that three times bigger, that's kind of their disposition during nesting. But other times of the year, they're not a threat to really anyone or other animals. They will have territorial disputes, of course, because everyone likes their own space. But here at the sanctuary, we can have up to 100 trumpeter swans in summer, and everyone gets along pretty well, I would say.
They're so big. What can you tell us about their place in the ecosystem? What trumpeter swans feed on, and maybe what their who their predators are?
So their predators can be larger carnivores. Historically, we had wolves in lower Michigan, which we don't anymore. But coyotes can still be a threat. If the swan has an illness, even foxes might try to take a trumpeter swan. But they are a really big bird. And their main threats right now are, of course, humans. Anything from their loss of habitat. Wetlands are really important for our ecosystems, especially in Michigan, and they really rely on that. They eat a lot of aquatic vegetation, and one of the things that will happen is they will eat that vegetation that's in the soil of the water, and they swallow it, which could include lead pellets. So lead poisoning is actually a big threat to trumpeter swans even now. It's one of their biggest threats in the wild.
Can you tell us the story of trumpeter swans in the region and sort of when it was that they were wiped out?
Yeah, so by 1959, actually, there were only 69 trumpeter swans in the United States that were known in the United States. And by then, people realized that this was a species in peril. They were endangered. And they were actually added to the first draft of the Endangered Species Act, which was 1966, the first draft. But then 2 years later, there was a statewide survey in Alaska which found almost 3,000 swans. So that increased the North American population to almost 3,000 trumpeter swans. And they decided, well, there seems to be enough swans, so we don't need to add it to our National Endangered Species Act. But a lot of states added it and still added it to their list. In fact, Michigan still lists the trumpeter swan as a threatened species.
When we talk about the trumpeter swan's decline in Michigan, I mean, that wasn't just lead poisoning, though, right? I mean, they were very widely hunted.
Oh, they were. So trumpeter swans were very prized for their feathers, anything from hats for women to powder puffs. In the early 1900s and late 1800s, we didn't have the synthetic powder puffs that we do now. So their down and their very fluffy feathers were really prized for that. And actually, John James Audubon, who is the namesake of the Audubon Society, he actually preferred trumpeter swan feathers for his quills. So there's, even in the Audubon Society, there's a history there of taking those swan feathers to use for other purposes.
Yikes. There was a wildlife biologist at the Kellogg Bird Sanctuary in the 1980s named Joe Johnson. And you mentioned the fact that there was this really healthy trumpeter swan population in Alaska. And Joe Johnson was the guy who brought trumpeter eggs from Alaska back to Michigan to try to restart the population. I want to play a little bit of audio. Here he is talking with Michigan Radio's Lester Graham back in the year 2000 about the surprising success of the trumpeter swan breeding program. Let's listen.
We thought if each pair produced two young per effort that we would be doing real well. That's basically their productivity in Alaska. But if we think of the Great Lakes as sort of the premier trumpeter swan habitat because of the length of our growing season, the productivity of our soils and our wetlands, then it's not a surprise that they're producing, on average, 3 young per nesting effort.
I mean, he did sort of lay it out there for us. But Sarah, can you think of other factors that led to the success of the trumpeter swan breeding program here?
Well, I think one of the biggest factors is where we are. The Kellogg Bird Sanctuary is located right on the Mississippi Flyway, so it's an important migration route for many species, not just trumpeter swans, but also native ducks. And from here, just having Joe's expertise, having the help of other agencies like DNR and other biologists, they were able to work out all of those problems over a series of a few years. And from here, all of the trumpeter swan cygnets were then released throughout Michigan. So it was a very successful program.
When Lester talked to Joe Johnson 20 years ago, they estimated more than 2,000 trumpeters in the Great Lakes region. How many do you figure we have today?
Well, the last statewide survey was in 2015. The DNR tries to do a survey every 5 years, and that one gave us an estimate of 3,000 trumpeter swans in the state of Michigan, which is a pretty significant increase from having zero in the 1980s.
That's amazing. Is the population large enough now that we might consider it close to what would have been normal for trumpeter swans had they not been wiped out?
It is still a fraction of what it historically was. And there are differing reports and estimates of what it might have been. But in the days where companies were taking 10,000 or 20,000 swans a year to make hats and powder puffs, the total North American population right now is hovering about 63,000. So we're still just a fraction of what it historically was. And there are states that are still doing reintroduction programs. I know that Iowa just finished theirs. They just had last week a release of swans. And Oregon, who we sent a swan to a couple years ago to help with their program, they are still in the midst of their trumpeter swan reintroduction as well.
Sarah, we've heard reports over the years of trumpeter swans being attacked or maimed or otherwise taken by people, even though they are a protected species. What would you say the biggest hurdles are to the birds these days?
Well, the biggest threat, of course, is lead poisoning. As we've seen in Michigan in the past few years, we know that lead is hazardous to all living things. And trumpeter swans especially, even if they're going into a new area, there might have been historic fishing or hunting in that area, and they can ingest those lead pellets. And even just a couple pellets in their system can be catastrophic for that bird. Of course, misidentification during hunting. Some people think that they are snow geese when they are flying, but of course they're much, much bigger than snow geese. And power lines actually can be hazardous to these swans as well, because as they're flying, they're very big birds, and as they're flying, they may not see those lines. So above ground power lines can be dangerous to them as well.
That said, with all of those hazards, which are considerable, do you think we're on an upward trajectory that will continue?
I think that we're on a path where the trumpeter swans, they continue to increase, but those threats are hazardous enough where you do worry about the future of the species if we don't get rid of the lead or help protect them by informing hunters of what the trumpeter swan looks like.
Sarah DePue-Bobby is an avian caretaker at the Kellogg Bird Sanctuary. Sarah, thanks for bringing us up to speed on where the trumpeters stand right now. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. I love trumpeter swans, and I love talking to people about them.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. President Biden's visit to Dearborn today coincides with three protests intended to draw attention to the battles tearing up Gaza. Here's what protesters sounded like at the Dearborn police station earlier in the day. Israel and Hamas are locked in a two-week clash that has dominated international headlines for 9 days. Michigan's Arab American population is diverse, with many ties in different parts of the world, but this conflict is deeply felt by many Michiganders with Palestinian roots. Michigan Radio's Caroline Yannis is in Dearborn today and joins us now. Hi, Caroline.
Hey, April.
Can you tell us a little bit about who helped to organize these protests? Do you get a sense that it was advocacy groups or a little more grassroots?
I would say that it's pretty grassroots. I was at a rally Sunday and I'm at another one today, and those were put on by college students at Wayne State's Students for Justice in Palestine. And this one was kind of organized in the past couple days. They only started planning it this Sunday. And so people, this community has kind of really come together really quickly to sort of respond to the concerns of the community and the pain that I think a lot of them are feeling.
Can you give us a sense of the size of the crowd, which we can hear behind you on scene?
Yeah, wow. There is 1,000 people here today, at least 1,000 according to the organizers, and it sure looks like you got people wearing their keffiyeh scarves, you've got a ton of Palestinian flags, people carrying signs. There's a lot of people that they've showed up and they've shown out today.
Caroline, between today and the protests you covered over the weekend, what are some of the common themes that folks were telling you about why they were out?
Well, I think there's, you know, despite the pain that people are feeling because of what's going on in Palestine, there's a real sense of hope that people are paying attention to what's going on, to the airstrikes by Israel and the violence that they're experiencing there. This is the kind of thing people have said that they could have lost their job for in years past. And they're really appreciating this renewed recognition. They've called the airstrikes by Israel and the planned evictions, acts of apartheid and ethnic cleansing. And it's really a new thing for them to be recognized as such by a wider audience, for these sentiments to be received. So I think people are really overwhelmed by what they perceive as sort of this new wave of support for Palestinians.
Caroline, President Joe Biden has a strong record of supporting Israel, and he's continued to say in his most recent comments this week that Israel has a right to defend itself from rocket attacks by Hamas. How are folks at the protest reacting to those kinds of statements?
Well, I think there's it's kind of hard for people to talk about the violence that their family members and their loved ones have experienced, but they perceive Israel is being the aggressor. They have come and they've evicted people, kicked them out of their homes, kicked their grandparents out of villages. And so for them, they perceive Israel as being the aggressor. And they say, what about the Palestinians' right to defend themselves? And they feel like there's not really a balanced perspective from the White House. What about the human rights violations committed against Palestinians? Why was there no mention of those? That sort of thing.
Yeah. The conflict between Israel and Palestinians has been going on for decades now, but a number of people have noted that there are some differences in the temperature associated with the latest clashes in Gaza. Have any of the protesters said anything to you about what might be different this time?
Yeah. So they think that social media is really playing a key role. People are kind of documenting what's happening to them as it happens, both in Israel and Palestinians alike. You have people showing these demolished buildings. You saw that AP and Al Jazeera press building fall down live as it happened. So I think there's kind of a renewed horror almost with that people are watching this sort of violence unfold. And social media has kind of become a really powerful tool in making people aware of what's happening as it's happening.
Michigan Radio's Caroline Yannis on scene in Dearborn today. Caroline, thanks very much. We'll watch for your reports on the website.
Thank you so much, April. Have a good one.
You can read Caroline's reporting at michiganradio.org. And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Mel Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.